Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 311. And we're live tonight in all the usual places. We're live on Odyssey, Rumble, DLive, and one of the unusual places. We're live on BitChute after having an excellent show with Ray, the owner of BitChute, last Sunday. He said, why don't you stream there? And I said, well, I've streamed there before, and there was a few teething problems, and it didn't really work out for me. But he's like, we fixed those. So if you are a BitChute viewer and this is your sort of first time watching live there, well, let's see how it goes. I don't know whether it's going to work or not, but let's hope it does. Anyway, those are the places we are live. Now, if you can share the stream, that will be very, very much appreciated. Now, the first thing you're going to notice is we're live with Chief Moody, and we were originally going to be live with Joel Davis. Joel's had a few problems, and he had to pull out at the last minute. I'm sure he's going to tell everyone what those issues are, what they relate to, and I really hope he will be back soon, because I've done quite a bit of work with Joel recently, but I've not actually had Joel on an episode of PWR for quite some time. So I look forward to working with him in the future, and obviously wish him all the best, and hopefully we can do a show again soon. Now, I've got a few things planned for later in the week. On Friday, I'll be live with Dr. David Duke at 4 p.m. on Friday evening, I'm going to do a live stream, because obviously it's the elections in the UK tomorrow. And if you are living in the UK, you will be aware that it's the county council elections. There's only 1,641 seats up for grabs, but it is still a major round of elections, albeit a smaller one than usual. So I will be covering that in depth. And there's quite a few interesting things about that. And me and the chief here, we will be discussing those a little bit later and giving a few of our predictions. Now, if you want to support, Sunday night, we won't be doing the Nationalist A team, or I doubt we will. It's because Natty's wife has given birth to their second child. Congratulations, Natty. They've got another little boy. We were going to announce that all on stream and everything, but he's announced that in a couple of chats. People know about that. It's in public chats, so I'm not sort of spilling the beans. But because of that, the little baby's only a couple of weeks old, and he's helping out a bit. So he's saying, like, it's very unlikely he'd be able to do that stream. So that leaves me with a stream that I need to fill on Sunday night. So I'm going to try and sort something out there. Don't know what I'm going to do, but there will be something. Now, if you'd like to help me out, if you'd like to contribute to this stream, if you would like to financially contribute to the work that I do, you can do so via Entropy. That's the only way to do that. And you can do it via clicking the link in the relevant chats. It's the pinned comment in every chat. And that's the only way you can support me now, because of the continued, despite Trump coming to power, the continued assault on content creators such as myself. That is just, what has happened, and it continues to happen. And obviously, I rely on your generosity to keep doing this. So if you do value my work, I would really, really appreciate it if you would consider making a small donation, $5, $10, whatever you can afford. I used to say $3, $5, $10, but Entropy's minimum buy-in, I believe, is... Oh, no, Entropy's minimum buy-in is $3, so $3, $5, $10, whatever you can afford. If you can afford to give generously, I'd really appreciate that. Obviously, every little helps, and if you can super chat, we will answer those super chats later into the show. Now, you can also donate via cryptocurrency, or my crypto links in the description below, or you can write to me at mark@westernman.com if you want to donate via other means. Anyway, we're going live now. Here's Chief Moody. Now, Chief Moody is a nationalist stalwart. He is a PA organizer for Scotland. He is a content creator, and he's a good friend of mine. He's also apparently a tasty man, and I say that because I thought I was the tastiest man around. And by that, I mean, every time I go camping, I get bitten by midges. And nobody seemed to ever come away from a camp with more bites than me. And I used to come home and sort of scrabble around looking for the antihistamines and the sort of special cream that you put on bug bites. But at last year's PA camp, Chief Moody literally got eaten alive. So not only is he a content creator activist, an all-around good guy. He's officially the tastiest man in nationalism, according to small flying insects that infest the English countryside. So, taking all that into account, Chief Moody, how are you doing, my friend?
Yeah, I'm doing fine, Mark. Thank you for having me on the show. And thank you for reminding me that absolute traumatizing event back at the camp last year. I wasn't actually expecting that many midgy bites, but, or I assume there are midgy bites, but yeah, hopefully, I'm definitely coming to the camp this year. So hopefully I'm going to be a lot more prepared this time around, having some stuff with me to maybe help to not get any more of those bites or whatever the case may be. So yeah, other than that, I've been not too bad. I've just been busy with work, being super busy with stuff behind the scenes with PA. I've mentioned just before we went live, I've also mentioned this on my show as well. I'm working on like a personal project of mine that's like a comic book type of idea. I don't really want to say an awful lot about it because it's still in the conceptual aspect of it type of thing. But yeah, that's pretty much what I've been doing for the past few weeks or months or so with regards to that. So yeah, hopefully it will be turn out to be a good show today. So.
Well, I'm hoping so too. And we're going to start tonight with a little bit of a chat about migration numbers. Now, for people who aren't living in Britain, they might not know this, but this has been one of the warmest and driest Aprils on record. I mean, it's been really, really hot. And in the UK, we have this sort of saying in April about April showers. It's meant to be a month when spring comes, basically. Spring's in sort of full effect in April. And it's meant to be punctuated by these April showers, where it's a very rainy month. And that's what allows the crops to all grow and, you know, gets the year into full swing. So our fields are full of produce, our fields are ready for the harvest later in the year, because obviously summer is the key growing season for the crops, and at the end of summer they get harvested. But this year we've had unseasonably warm weather, so warm actually that we've had the paddling pool out in our house, and my daughter's been splashing around in that. It's been absolutely boiling. It's sweltering today in the room I'm in now. You can probably hear the fan on my computer because that's going into overdrive just because it's so warm in the house today, about 24, 25 degrees. And because of this, and because of the lack of rain and the lack of sort of seasonal downpours, it's basically been open season on our southern border, with us having recorded a record number of migrants by this point in the year and breaking the all-time record number of channel crossings to ever take place in a week. It usually averages that there's around 1,000 crossings or 1,000 people cross per week, but they've broken a new record with over 2,000 crossing in a single week, which is pretty incredible. And this is all, as I said, before the end of April, with total numbers topping over 10,000. Now, when I say there's been over 10,000 channel crossings, that is just a portion of the number of illegal migrants that enter the UK. And when I say 10,000, 10,000 is the ones they know about. Now, I am pretty sure there will be channel crossings that go unaccounted for, where people jump off the little boats, they're not collected by the border force, they run up on the beaches to meet vans or lorries, jump in the back of the lorries and disappear, never to be accounted for. So what we can safely say is that even by the media and the government statistics, we are seeing record levels of illegal immigration on our southern border. And if that's mirrored elsewhere with people overstaying visas, coming through the Channel Tunnel, and maybe getting here via other means, so that there are other ferry routes and other ports around the UK, we can safely say that illegal immigration has increased dramatically under this Labour government. Now, most of these people go on to be the ones you see being put in hotels. But now the hotels are so full, the Labour government are begging landlords to sign up to a new agreement to let their homes out, or their houses out, on a semi-permanent leases. So it's sort of like a rolling lease to the government so they can house illegal migrants who have immediate, they all immediately claim asylum, but to house these illegal migrants in houses rather than hotels, because the hotels have all filled up. And the budget that they initially earmarked for spending on these hotels has risen and risen and risen. No government's been able to get it down, but now they're moving into housing estates all over Britain. And it's all being paid for, obviously, by the taxpayer, who are being increasingly squeezed because apparently there's no money left in the pot. But there's always plenty of money to house these illegal migrants. So what do you think of this, Chief? Is this what you expected under Labour? Or did you actually expect Labour to maybe bring it down a bit?
I mean, yeah, what exactly can be said at this point? I mean, as soon as Labour got in, back in, what was it, like summer of last year, if I remember correctly, myself and a few others within the movement knew that there's something like this was going to happen. Like, there's going to be floods of migrants coming into the country. They're going to be housed and all of that. So I don't want to come off as a, like someone like a Debbie Downer type of thing, but or even blackpilling, but it's just, it's not really that much of a surprise really at this point. I mean, the only thing I would imagine what's going to be happening now is that there seems to be this this idea of wanting to build more housing in the sort of countryside areas or anywhere like that, that are not specifically any houses like nearby or in any of those areas, then yeah, there really is like a massive push to have these kinds of people into the nation. And again, we all know why that is. It's all because of wanting to replace the native population of these islands. So yeah, I mean, in short, not really that much of a surprise, to be honest with you. So
the thing that worries me, so I'm not saying I'm a fan of the hotel system, because the hotel system doesn't work. It's a ripoff. It costs billions and billions of pounds per year. But the hotel system, despite being absolutely broken and scandalous, and I don't support, I'm just saying all this because I know that somebody will clip it out and make it sound like I'm sort of endorsing putting these people in five-star hotels, which I'm actually not. But I kind of do see the hotel system almost as if it's the lesser of two evils, which sounds like a weird thing to say. And I think it's the lesser of two evils because I don't want them here at all. But if they're here, you'd kind of want them in a place where they're all together and they can be monitored. I mean, the best place for them would be secure camps. So to have actual internment camps where they were kept. So they couldn't leave. They couldn't go out of the boundaries. They couldn't interact with normal people. And they are kept in these sort of like, almost like prison camps, if you like. But they wouldn't be in prison, but they wouldn't be allowed to just roam free and disappear. That would be the ideal case scenario. Now, that isn't going to happen. No government is going to put these people in internment camps because people say, oh, it's like concentration camps. Oh, it's all happening again. It's fascism. So they put them in these hotels. Now, I don't want them in the hotels, but when they're in the hotels, at least they're contained in one area. You can say, you know, that hotel there, you know, I'm not going to name a hotel brand, Britannia Hotels. Actually, I will name them because Britannia Hotels in Leeds we've actually, you know, done protests outside Britannia Hotels in Leeds. I used to go, there was a Britannia Hotel in Leeds in a place called Seacroft. I used to go there occasionally because you used to do a Sunday lunch carvery. That has been booked up apparently till around 2030. So the government have given them sort of this asylum seeker contract and it will last till the end of the decade. And I'm sure at that point it will be renewed again. But at least you know that's where they are. They're all in that hotel. Don't go near that hotel. And it can kind of be monitored a little bit more effectively. However, one thing that really worries me is once you start putting them in housing estates, in social housing, in rented housing, they will just begin to sort of disappear. And not only will they begin to disappear, but they're living in estates around normal people. And these are just rentals. So if you live in a nice estate, so you've bought your house, you know, you meet a nice lady, you decide you're going to buy a house, there's a new build estate going up, you put some money down, you paid your deposit, and that's it. You want to buy your property. That's what you're going to do. You buy your property, but somebody on that estate says, well, my parents died a couple of years ago. We're going to buy ourselves a house, but we're also going to buy another house on the estate and rent it out. And all of a sudden, that couple are offered X many thousand pounds to house a family of asylum seekers on the estate. And all of a sudden, they're not just contained in this one place. They are on every estate all over the country, and they are much, much more of a threat and much, much more likely, I believe, to sort of disappear, abscond, you know, break any terms that they may have. And I think that's really, really concerning. What's more, once you start putting them in housing estates, how close are these people to schools? Now, I'm not saying every one of them is a rapist who's going to go after children, but there have been a number, and enough of these have taken place. There's been enough of this for a pattern to be clear. There's been a number of these cases around schools where these asylum seekers, these illegal immigrants, they come out of the hotels, they start congregating around schools. But generally speaking, hotels are a little bit of a distance from schools. You don't, you know, they're not things you regularly see side by side, but you do see schools in the middle of housing estates. And my worry here is this is going to place these people who are coming here now in overwhelming numbers around more British families, around more British children, and with access to more schools and more places children play. And I think this is going to lead to a marked increase in sexual assaults and specifically the harassment of young girls.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. I think it really just depends on the area itself as well, because I remember going back to the Erskine demonstrations we did, well, I think last year or the year before, where the hotel was, quite close by to it, was actually, I believe it was a primary, no, it was a nursery or like a primary school, if I remember. It might have been more of a nursery, but the point is, it's very close by to where kids are normally occupied. And of course, the parents are, of course, understandably so, were deeply concerned about that. And it's also very close by with the housing area, because it's literally just across the road from where the roundabout is in that area. And there's a housing area, like block of flats and singular houses and all of that. And there have been reports of these migrants going into the neighbors' back gardens and all of that, and been caught, you know, potentially trying to steal stuff and all of that. So for me, when it comes to that, I personally would not, obviously it's not, everyone kind of shares this opinion, but I personally don't really want these people, whether in the hotels or anything like that at all. And that's merely because of the fact that we just don't really know who they are, where they came from, or even what exactly. They claim they're fleeing from war-torn countries, but as we all know, that's not entirely true when it comes to that. Most of them actually came from either like France or other neighboring countries. So last time I checked, France is not exactly like a war-torn country. But that being said, yeah, so it is deeply worrying. And I think it's definitely something that it really needs to be called out for. But again, it's not going to be called out. And even that idea, which I kind of agreed with the internment camps, whatever, again, that's definitely not going to happen, because, again, you're going to get the lefty globalist types who are just like, oh, well, that goes against their civil rights and, you know, their human rights will be in jeopardy and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, you may say it that, but you were nowhere to be found when it comes to the sexual assaults that keep happening to our little girls. But I guess one cause is much more important than the other regarding to that. But yeah, I mean, that's really all I have to say about that on the matter. So
now, obviously, this is a big political issue. And what we're seeing here is illegal immigration. But legal immigration, they're saying, has dropped by about a third. Now, obviously, the last figures we had on net migration were around 906,000 people coming legally to the country. I think about 1.5 million people entered the country. So if it drops by about a third, we're going to see sort of about a million people coming here. And maybe that dropping net migration down to 600,000. Now, a lot of that is being chalked up not to the Labour Party, but actually to changes the Conservatives made before they were booted out that are just sort of kicking in now. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think there is going to be a little bit of a charge by the mainstream over the next sort of year, year and a half, to try and capture the issue of mass immigration, from the sense that fundamentally they're pretty worried about the Reform Party at the moment?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty surprised at that. I would have thought, because of whether they came here legally or illegally, that there's going to be, again, more birth rates keep going up from those types of groups. But yeah, I would imagine, because it's part of the overall agenda of trying to replace the native populations, I would imagine the mainstream media would try and maybe make some kind of agenda about, like, oh, there's like decrease in birth rates when it comes to the people who are either born overseas but came here legally and all of that. Yeah, you'll definitely see maybe a bit of a push regarding to that, and as with Reform UK, maybe it might have something to do with that, in my opinion, I don't know, but it's definitely showing that there's a growing trend and maybe a slight growing popularity of sorts with Reform UK, but that's, yeah, my opinion on that. So,
well, I mean, it is the elections tomorrow. It's election day tomorrow. Now, as I said, this is a smaller round of elections. You don't usually have elections that are this small. Generally speaking, if it's council elections, there can be somewhere between sort of 6,000 and 8,000 seats up for grabs. If it's a general election, obviously that's nationwide. Sometimes you have these large regional elections, Scottish Parliament, Welsh Assembly, or the Greater London Assembly. But this is just county councils. And tomorrow there are 1,641 seats up for grabs. And the party that's standing in the most number of seats is actually Reform. Reform are standing 1,631 candidates. Now, as far as I can see, that's a pretty impressive tally, because usually you would expect either in elections like this, which are county council, usually more sort of rural areas, you know, places where the Conservatives usually dominate. You know, inner city areas are generally Labour areas, more rural, suburban areas are usually Conservative areas. That's kind of how it goes. If you look at a map of the breakdown of voting patterns, it actually looks like, in terms of land, there's more Conservative areas than there is Labour areas. It's just people are generally concentrated in urban areas. And because of that, the map shows these little red dots in high population areas, which are Labour, and these vast areas of countryside, which are all blue, where there's lower population density and people vote Conservative. But these are in areas where people would generally vote Conservative. I'm not sure how many Labour county councillors there are, but this could be a real landmark election, despite it being so small. Because this will be a barometer, really, of how much Reform have grown since the last general election. In the last general election, they won 5 seats, which was an incredible breakthrough, but it was only 5 seats out of 650 available. So it was, you know, less than 1%. But since then, they've gone from being a party with about 50,000 members to a party with 226,000 members. They are now bigger than the Conservatives, and Cammy Badenoch and Robert Jenrick from the Conservative Party have been going hell for leather trying to convince the British public that they got it totally wrong about immigration, they're really, really sorry, and now, you know, you should be trusting them, give them another chance kind of thing. But Farage has gone all out in the run-up to these elections, and he said a number of things which are very important. The first is he has said he would never have a coalition with the Conservatives because they're basically sellouts and his party would fracture and they'd all leave because he doesn't want anything to do with them. Now, that's a big change from the things that he's previously said. The next thing he started talking about is mass deportations. And he's made two quotes to the press. The first, which is, well, he's made numerous sort of speeches or quotes to the press. But the first, which is very, very interesting, is he's actually come out and said that the government needs to appoint a minister for deportations. Now, that is something which he was taking a step back from a while ago, but now he's saying we need a minister of deportations because things are so bad, we actually need a proper ministerial post to oversee the mass deportations that this country needs and that the voters want. So again, that's really, really important. And he's actually now saying as well that if he becomes the next prime minister, and I'm going to quote him, he says he wants to be the deporter in chief. So he says he wants to be the guy in charge of mass deportations. So firstly, he's saying, don't vote Conservative. We're never going to have a pact with them. They're complete sellouts. This is why the country's in a mess. Secondly, we need a minister of deportations. And then he says, and I want to be that guy. If I become the next prime minister, I'm going to be the deporter in chief. These people are going back. Now, not long ago, he was saying the very opposite of all of this, saying like, oh, mass deportations are unrealistic. You know, going about this would, you know, sort of hinting that going about this might cause a civil war, et cetera, et cetera. But now he's going full ham for it. What do you think about Farage's about turn? Is this just because it's election day, or has he finally realised that that's what the public wants?
I think it's a bit of both in terms of he does realise that this is something the public definitely does want in terms of mass deportations and all of that. I mean, there's a reason why, as much as we might not be fans of Reform UK, like, oh, they're slightly cucked on certain things and all of that, but to the general public, it's definitely, to them anyway, the better option compared to what they've had for years being Labour and the Tories. The Tories, as we know, when they were in power for 14, almost 15 years, was a complete disaster. Multiple replacements for prime ministers and all of that, and then of course last year we've had Labour come in, and that was a complete disaster. And now the public are just sick to the back teeth of it, and they genuinely want that change. They really want to see that difference, to the point where they would go to a group like Reform UK and even people like Nigel Farage as like a beacon of hope type of thing. Now, saying that, I also think, so I do believe that Nigel Farage does believe that's what the people want. The other point, in terms of like it kind of wanting both ways, I think it's primarily to do with some form of egotism. Now, we've seen what happened with Rupert Lowe and how he pretty much threw that guy under the bus, and how, and well, I'm actually surprised that Reform UK are actually still going, because I did see a lot of people were not happy with what the treatment behind Rupert Lowe. But I do strongly believe that it's entirely to do with like egotism. Like, oh, I'm going to be the one in charge. I'm going to be the one who's going to be the chief of deportations and all that. It's all this like me. And that's what I'm coming from when it comes to that. It seems to me anyway, and maybe even to a lot of other people, it's entirely to do with egotism, because he's like, well, I'm Nigel Farage. I have to be somewhat the hero of British politics, as it were. So.
I agree, but I think something else is happening here. Now, I want to sort of give a little bit of a disclaimer before I say this. I don't believe that Nigel Farage is the real deal, and I don't think Nigel Farage is going to be the man that brings about real change in the UK. I think Nigel Farage could play an interesting role in destroying the Conservative Party, but I don't believe him. So I don't want to be sort of misquoted on this issue. But I will say this, since Farage and Reform have become so big, and since they've exploded since the last general election, they have really worried the Conservative Party. Now, that has led to Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick really going hard on the idea of shutting the borders, deporting illegal migrants, and also talking about a grooming gang inquiry, because that's the other thing that Reform have promised. They've said, if we become the government, we will give you the grooming gang inquiry. So that's some interesting promises there from Farage. He wants to be the deporter in chief. He wants to set up a minister for deportations. And on top of that, he won't work with the Conservatives, but he will give the public a grooming gang inquiry. So he's going in pretty hard. But the Conservatives are saying very similar things because they're seeing how his party's growing. They're seeing that they've been overtaken in terms of membership numbers by Reform. And they're saying, oh, my God, what are we going to do? So now you've got Kemi Badenoch saying, look, we realise we've made mistakes. We need to close the borders. We need to start deporting people. You've got Robert Jenrick using terms like two-tier policing and coming out with the sort of rhetoric that you'd hear on this show. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, people were calling for me to actually be arrested for talking about two-tier policing and calling the Southport murderer an African. Now, that's the kind of political talk that was floating around a few months ago. And the Home Office even branded the term two-tier policing as far-right extremism. But now Robert Jenrick is using that term in Parliament. And this puts Nigel Farage in a really interesting position because the Tories have shifted right. Now, I know that the Conservatives are not going to make good on any of those things. They've had 14 years to get immigration under control. They had 14 years to give us a grooming gang inquiry. They had 14 years to start deporting the millions of illegal immigrants who are in Britain. They did nothing. In fact, they increased migration numbers to record levels, like absolutely ridiculous levels, like almost a million net migrants in a single year. That's just the legal one. So, you know, definitely over a million when you take into account illegal and legal. So you've got all that happening. All of that's happening. And now the Conservatives are shifting to the right because they can see they're losing ground because of Farage. But because they're shifting to the right, Farage has to shift a little further to the right to remain in a position where his talking points are differentiated from the Conservative talking points. And what I'm kind of liking here is the fact that this rightward shift not only legitimizes everything we've said, but is actually getting the public talking about the issues that we've been pushing for decades. So now the issue of mass immigration and the necessary deportations are being pushed by both the Conservatives and Farage. And I think it's quite interesting that Farage has had to double back. He's had to double down. He's had to go harder than the Conservatives, who are going pretty hard themselves in terms of a mainstream centrist party. I think what we could have here is the door opening to legitimate debate on demographics and whether Britain should remain a white British country. And that's thanks to this sort of race to the right that's been initiated by Reform getting those candidates elected.
Yeah, 100%. I was also going to mention about the Tories wanting to get back into power. I have a suspicion that the general public here in Britain are a lot smarter than what the mainstream media would think. And that's mainly because of the, as we said, the 14 years of being in power, you know, like broken promise after broken promise. And, you know, if the Tories think that, oh, well this time around, I mean, yeah, we may have messed up things in the past before, but don't worry, guys, it's pretty bad now with the Labour, but don't worry, we're going to make things right. We're actually going to, for once and finally, listen to what you, the public, have to say. They're not going to do it. You know, they may say, like, oh, they're going to do this, they're going to do that. They're not going to do it because they've done that in the past before, and they keep on breaking those promises. So, yeah, again, this idea that Reform UK is garnering a lot of attention and a lot of support, and there's a good reason. It's because of what the Tories have done and what the current Labour government are currently doing. So, yeah, that's my take on that. So.
Well, the interesting thing about this, Peter Whittle, who is a former GLA member and a major player in UKIP and the Farageist movement in the past, he posted this on Twitter in the last 24 hours. He put, white Britons will be a minority in this country by the mid-2070s or even earlier, the mid-2060s, according to predictions which are increasingly accepted by mainstream journalists and policy organisations. This is not some science fiction future. It is a matter of decades, certainly within the lifetimes of some of us, our children and grandchildren. Yet this massive historical demographic change is barely discussed. If one takes the traditional marker of 1066 as the beginning of our modern history, then we are talking about 1,000 years. If I want to ask you, how does this make you feel? Dismay, sadness, resignation, or indifference? So this is a guy, and he's a homosexual. He's a former GLA member, former sort of, you know, part of the Farageist movement. But he's now basically saying the kind of things that I was kicked off YouTube for talking about. You know, the things that we were all deplatformed for, the things that we were all booted off mainstream platforms, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You've now got pretty much mainstream people we would regard as sort of mainstream sellout types, and certainly not ethno-nationalists, talking about and saying, is this actually what we want? Is this actually a good thing for Britain? I mean, from my perspective, the answer is obviously a resounding no. But I do think it's interesting that we are living in times where there is a race to, you know, see who can say the most, who can voice the most radical policy about deportations between Reform and the Conservatives. But equally, people who were seen as kind of metrosexual, sort of slightly right of center, but definitely not ethno-nationalists, are now making the sort of points that at one point were laughed at, ridiculed, and in some cases actually criminalized. You've got to remember, people like Sam Melia went to prison for putting facts like this on stickers, which went up on lampposts. You know, when it comes down to it, this to me is a serious sort of sea change and shift in the narrative. Now, whether I think it'll make a difference or not, we'll come back to in a second. But have your say on this, Chief, and then I'll give my say on whether I think this will make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's I do agree that it's definitely a good thing that it's becoming a lot more prevalent in our society with these talking points. I mean, yeah, especially back in the day where it was like, whoa, like white replacement, like what are you, a complete crank? You know, it's like, but yeah, it's definitely becoming a lot more recognized. I think people are definitely just, the reason why they're accepting it a lot more compared to years ago, it's because it's becoming a lot more prevalent. People are definitely starting to see the changes in demographics. Even people who might not see race, like, oh, I don't see race. I see them as, like, people, as human beings. We're all human beings, man. But they can definitely see it. You can definitely see it in, like, of course, in the major metropolitan areas or cities. And yeah, like, people are just starting to see through it. And I think that definitely does worry a lot of people, even though they might say in public, oh, well, I mean, like, why does it even matter? I mean, like, what does it even mean to be white? You know, all this ridiculous stuff. But I think deep down, people are definitely more concerned with it. And it's definitely good to see that it's becoming more and more popularized and bringing up a lot more, despite the fact that people in question who are talking about this stuff, whether it be called the mainstream right or the, well, I prefer to call them the gatekeeper right. They definitely would talk about the stuff, but at the same time, they're just like, well, yeah, this is all happening, but just don't go that far to the right. Instead, come over here. It's way easier and all of that. But that's what the way I see it was. Yeah, it is a good thing that's being talked about. At the same time, those types of people, like Farage, for instance, would try and gatekeep and try to make people not come over necessarily to our side, but just maybe just right enough to the point where they're not seeing it as like, oh, well, clearly this has something to do with race, and it definitely does play a factor into society. But
well, I'll say this. I was going to say sort of my next point was going to be whether I think any of this will make a difference, and I'm not sure it will. And the reason I'm not sure it will is because there isn't a party that exists in Britain that will do what is necessary in order to turn around this mess. And the other reason I don't think it'll make a difference is because I think there are far too many migrants in the country now who are at the youngest and lowest parts of the population pyramid. And I think unless there was some serious sea change in the way people think, which would involve lots of non-white people leaving and lots of young British couples breeding many, many times over and having large families, I think this would be very, very difficult to turn around now. And I don't think there's a will to do that. I think the problem is, at the moment, the demographic decline of the British people is accelerating at an alarming rate. So even if we slowed it down slightly, we wouldn't actually be reversing it. It would just be happening at a slightly less alarming rate. And one of my biggest worries at the moment, in fact, is that despite all this seeming like we're making real progress, and it does seem like we're making real progress, so I don't want to be the person pouring cold water on things. It's Chief Moody disappeared. But despite the fact that we are making this progress, and despite the fact things seem to be moving in our direction, I think we face a serious, serious issue. And that serious issue is, if Labour do, or if migration numbers keep declining under Labour, I think people may well be satisfied. So if Labour say, look, migration numbers have dipped by a third, people are going to be like, well, that's not bad, is it? Well, it depends what you're starting with. You know, if you're starting from the point that you've got net migration of 1 million people, and then you say, well, numbers have dipped by a third, well, you're still bringing in sort of 660,000 people a year. Now, that's a massive number of people. And remember, it wasn't that long ago when bringing in 100,000 people a year was seen as massive. I remember when successive Conservative Party prime ministers made pledges pre their election that they were going to get immigration numbers down to the tens of thousands. Theresa May said it, David Cameron said it. You know, the idea of migration numbers being into six-figure digits was just unthinkable. It's like, well, this won't go on. You know, we've just got to get it down to the tens of thousands. Now, getting it down to sort of under 500,000 will be met with rapturous applause. And you're like, well, how's this happened? How have we gone from it needs to be under 100,000 to, oh, yes, we've nearly got it down to 500,000. And this is the problem with both the political system, the mainstream media, but also it's a problem with the British public. And I'm one of the few content creators that will come out and say this, but the British public are a problem. And they're a problem because they are so easily fooled. Time and time again, the British public are easily fooled and they just accept this absolute crap again and again and again. And I think we're going to hit a point pretty soon where Labour and the mainstream start to crow that immigration numbers have fallen significantly, and they will as a percentage. You know, if you say you're reducing a problem by 33%, that is impressive. But the problem is the raw figures are still so absolutely swamping, it's unbelievable. And as I said a while ago on a different stream, when you look at the deaths of elderly white Brits in Britain every year, for every elderly white Brit that dies, there is at least one migrant who settles here permanently. That is replacement. And over the next 25 years, statistically, 11.2 million white Brits aged today 65 or older will die. And if they're being replaced at a rate of at least one migrant coming in for each one that dies, that means over the next 25 years, a minimum of 22.4 million migrants will come into Britain. And I said at least, because I'm going to make the guess that the actual number over the next 25 years will be greater than that. And I make that guess because, number one, they will never let the population shrink. Number two, they are not going to find people to do certain jobs. You know, there's going to be plenty of jobs still there for migrants. You know, all these Deliveroo drivers and Uber drivers, they're not white people. They're just not. And finally, I think the other big issue that we're going to face is as the population ages, the government will tell them or tell the public that we need these people to work as carers because white people aren't having children. And I think that will actually be increasingly a conservative talking point, that if you want to live well into your old age, you're going to need, you know, Zimbabwean, Kenyan, Ugandan carers coming in to, you know, change your bed sheets. It's unfortunate, but I just don't see this. People are talking, the things that people are talking about now, we needed them to talk about in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, the 2000s at the latest. But we are now 50 years on from when this conversation should have begun. And it's just beginning now, which means logically, by the time the remaining whites have come up with a viable solution, my great fear is there won't be enough of us left to enact that solution, and certainly won't be enough of us left to vote our way out of it. Especially, you know, one thing you can say about migrants, they have more kids than whites. We agree. The other thing you can say about migrants, especially the Indians, the Pakistanis, and those from the Middle East, is they vote in greater number than white people. So they're breeding at a quicker rate than we are, and they're voting proportionately in greater numbers. Those two things are absolutely catastrophic because their numbers are increasing and they leverage those numbers against us much more effectively than we leverage our numbers against them. Is there anything you'd like to say about that before we walk into the interesting topic of Zionists taking over nationalism?
Yeah, well, that's me back. Sorry about that. My internet cut off for a really bad time in there. But I mean, like, just hearing that, just that last part there, it's, yeah, no wonder that a lot more of these migrants are having more children. And of course, they're casting a lot more votes than, say, the white population. More specifically, when they do vote, what I've noticed and a lot of other people have noticed is they do tend to vote for people that are the same as them with regards to that. So in a sense, you could even say, again, it's not an original point, I know, but you can make the point about it's all also to do with like in-group preferences type of thing. So whenever they see someone who's very similar to them in terms of their kin, then they're going to vote for that person. So yeah, it's definitely a case of, it is very worrying unless we talk about this particular topic now, because it's if we don't, it's just going to get more and more worse as we go along. So
now the next thing I want to talk about, obviously there was a conference last weekend which seemed to not go down as well as the organizers had hoped, because the organization hosting it had a major split the week before, and the split was all based around the acceptance of homosexual cross-dressing cat boys that like black male partners. Now, I can't endorse that kind of lifestyle, interestingly enough. I'm not a cat boy enjoyer, nor am I somebody who... look, it's beyond the pale. Now, obviously, there were people in that organization like Zuma Historian and Steve Laws who were very principled, and they had principled followers. They've all walked away. But this conference that took place last weekend, which was meant to be the big remigration conference, well, it wasn't that big, and it really did shine a light on the people who want remigration and why they want remigration. And it got me thinking, actually, but talking about kind of a larger issue, and that larger issue is the issue of Zionists co-opting nationalist parties in Europe. Now, there was a big sort of furore over a guy called Renard Camus. And Renard Camus is a French speaker who was invited to this conference. Now, just for the record, he's an elderly French homosexual and Zionist. And when he was banned from coming into the country, I wasn't particularly bothered. I mean, I'm not really sure I want more sort of gay Zionists in the country. They're not top of my list of people that I would be sharing a platform with. But they are curiously a group of people that have increasingly voiced their concern about mass immigration. But they're voicing their concern about mass immigration almost as a way to co-opt nationalist movements. And they do bring with them a significant amount of money. But they're co-opting nationalist movements not because they want to save the white race, But increasingly, because they're worried about two things. The first thing they're worried about is open displays of homosexual deviancy in public that you sort of see at pride parades will be banned if the Muslim population continues to grow. Now, I don't think that's a bad thing. There's not many positives of Muslims taking over Britain. But one of the things which is sort of a silver lining to a rather dark cloud is that we wouldn't be having grown men urinating on each other in public on a summer's day in front of children at a pride parade. That would be shut down. Well, that upsets a lot of these elderly homosexuals. And the other thing is a lot of these Muslims who have come here, I don't want them here, would rather they go, they are anti-Zionist and they are anti-Israel. And what you're seeing now is an attempt by homosexuals and Zionists to move into the nationalist movement and to buy influence and begin co-opting nationalist groups that are open to selling out the fundamental principles of nationalism for short-term gain and financial gain. And this is what we saw last weekend. And I'm going to read this directly from Renard Camus' Twitter. So this is the speech he was going to make in Britain. And I'm going to read it verbatim. So here I begin, and I quote, "A classical move is to accuse the Jews, and indeed the Jews, after the Second World War and death camps, had every reason to blame Europe for all the harm it had done them, whether through deliberate criminal intent or plain indifference." So I'm going to read that again, because it's not particularly clear, but I'm going to read it again. "A classical move is to accuse the Jews, and indeed the Jews, after the Second World War and death camps, had every reason to blame Europe for all the harm it had done them, whether through deliberate criminal intent or plain indifference." So this guy is fully pushing the poisonous post-Second World War narrative. He's pushing the death camp narrative. He's pushing white guilt. And he's saying that Europe did terrible harm to Jews. And he's pushing white guilt in the most disgusting manner. He's pushing white guilt by saying that even the whites who didn't do nasty things to Jews are also guilty because of their indifference. I continue, and I quote, "Jewish intellectuals, journalists and statesmen have long played an undeniable part in the efforts to make massive immigration acceptable." That's correct, if not popular. "But things are changing fast, although not as fast as one might desire. For one thing, international finance is now quite far from being as essentially Jewish as it might once have been, and is now just as much, if not more, Muslim, Chinese, Protestant, and even Catholic as it is Jewish." Well, I'm going to stop there for a minute and say he's lying through his teeth. You only have to read any of David Duke's work to understand that. Anyway, I'll continue to quote him. "And people who accuse one of being Jewish, and people who accuse one of being anti-Semitic just because one thinks, as indeed I do, that financial interests are playing an essential part in the genocide by replacement, are showing nothing but their own anti-Semitism, since international finance and the Jews are, for them, two names for the same thing, an absurdity on its face." So I was going to stop there again. So he's basically using terms like anti-Semitism, and he's saying, yeah, international finance does play a role, but it's not Jewish, and to conflate the two is anti-Semitic. I mean, the guy's a complete idiot, but we'll continue. He goes on, "No, when I speak of Davos and the Davocratic management of the Human Park by Hedges Fund, pension funds and the GAFAM, big tech and big state, I certainly do not mean the Jews. And how could I? Since everywhere in Europe, rank and file Jews are among the countless victims of the Great Replacement, the first and the most cruelly affected to such extent, nowhere is safe for them." So this guy who came to speak to the British public about the Great Replacement pushes several things. Firstly, white people should suffer from white guilt because it's their fault lots of Jews died, and even if they didn't take any part in it, it's their fault because they were indifferent to it. So bad whitey. And secondly, he pushes this idea that, in fact, Jews don't control the financial industries. They're no longer pushing mass immigration. Some of them might have done in the past, but actually The Great Replacement is a problem that primarily affects Jews. So in fact, and I'll quote him again, rank and file Jews are among the countless victims of the Great Replacement, the first and the most cruelly affected to such extent that nowhere is safe for them. This is the man that a so-called nationalist party brought to Europe, or sorry, brought to Britain, he's European, he's French, brought to Britain to give a speech about remigration. But the speech ended up being a white guilt fest that pushed the narrative that, in fact, it's actually a problem that affects Jews the most. What's your take on this, Chief Moody?
I mean, yeah, just how ridiculous that is. And I actually do believe it does bring that conference, or the people behind the conference, brought into question. Because from what I remember, okay, because we all know who we're talking about in this case, right? They splintered off because they think we're not being serious about politics, or at least the voting aspect about politics. And they wanted to get into the electoral politics section, or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, they claim to be like, we're the ethno-nationalist party and all that. But yet they have no problem hiring femboys or catboys, whatever you want to call them, as like regional organizers. Or in this case, we want to have this homosexual Zionist. But just remember, folks, we're nationalists, but we're sensible nationalists. Which, look, let's just be blunt and honest here, right? Sensible nationalism is basically code words for civic nationalism. Because the way they may say that, oh, we're ethno-nationalists and all that, but their actions betray their words. Because, and a lot of people, it's not just myself or you, Mark, or anyone in the chat, a lot of people in our movement are saying this or even asking these questions. Whenever you have people like this French dude, whatever his name was, Canos or whatever you want to pronounce his name, a lot of people tend to ask this party, if you want to call it that, you know, you claim to be like an ethno-nationalist group or party. Why are you aligning yourselves with this guy who is not only just, you know, homosexual, but he's a staunch supporter of Israel and he's an open Zionist? And I have a theory when it comes to that. And again, it might not be an original point, I know, but it's all part of the whole gatekeeping. It's just an idea to try and subvert nationalism for what it really is. Nationalism, to me anyway, and maybe people might agree with this or maybe not, but nationalism is the idea of nation and people. Like the people built a nation, that sort of idea. What these people, in my opinion, are trying to do is they're trying to co-opt that, they're trying to subvert that by saying, oh, well, no, if you're somebody who talks about nationalism but also talks about Jews and the Jewish question and all that, then the new term we're throwing out now, say someone like me or you, Mark, or people in the chat, as crackpot nationalists or crank nationalists or bad actors or whatever the case. And the only reason they're saying that is because we talk about the Jews and the Jewish question. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of evidence to support the fact, there's a lot of points to be made about financing and the entertainment industry and all that. You may see a certain group of people behind those industries that end with Stein or Bergs, and you're like, I don't want to come off as an anti-Semitic or a far-right conspiracy theorist, but you look at that and you think, there's something not adding up here. There's almost like a group of people that seem to be behind the scenes of everything and seem to be controlling a lot of everything, including the narrative with the mainstream media and whatnot. And was I do find it a bit funny that this French dude again was making a point about, oh, the Jews have no place to go. It's like, they got Israel. I mean, okay, stolen land from the Palestinians, but they still got their own homeland. I mean, yeah, it's just like, it's absolutely ridiculous. And like, the fact that this party is allowing these types of people in their ranks, while at the same time having the audacity to call themselves ethno-nationalists, is just not only just absolutely embarrassing, but it's absolutely disgusting, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, they have dropped the term, to be fair. They have actually dropped the term ethno-nationalist, and they ban people from using that term because they want to be seen as a group apart from genuine, racial nationalists such as ourselves. But the thing that concerns me the most is sort of what kind of Europe are we trying to build? I'm trying to build a Europe for my children, my grandchildren, and for people of European descent. I want England for the English, France for the French, Germany for the Germans. I don't want a Europe which is primarily there for liberal homosexual Zionists to have some kind of, financial playground where they can hold us all in the chains of usury, parade down the street carrying out deviant acts and basically party on Europe's grave. That's not the Europe that we want to create. And if you're fighting for that kind of Europe, you're also an enemy of nationalism. There's no point having a racially homogeneous Europe so that we can all wallow in filth and live in financial chains. The idea of a racially homogeneous Europe is so it's a safe place for children, and so we're free. So we're free from financial bondage. So we're free to bring up our children in a safe and healthy place. I don't want people like Renard Camus around my children. I don't want people who are advocating for gay pride events infiltrating, family-friendly societies and spreading their message. Now, look, if he does what he does behind closed doors, that's up to him. I'm fine with that. He can get up to what he wants. But he is a man who readily admits that he isn't a nationalist and that first and foremost, he's a homosexual Zionist. They are the things that he defines himself by. He doesn't define himself by being a white European who wants a white Europe. He defines himself as being a homosexual Zionist that wants a Europe that is a cradle for those ideals. I don't. I want a Europe that is a cradle for our ideals, where we can take our destiny into our own hands and lead our people to an actual better place. I don't want to leave a multiracial society to hop into a society that is a moral sewer where we're surrounded, by pornography and all the excesses of a predatory financial group of vampires that control our spending and our credit and hold those chains over us. Because I understand the damage that that kind of system does to families and especially people on low incomes who get trapped in this cycle of debt. We want to be free, not just free to live amongst ourselves, but free to live a genuinely better life.
Yeah, there was also another point I wanted to make about that in terms of this group or party that are doing this, despite the fact they've had, their certain opinions in the past and all of that. And they're not the first and only group that have done this. A lot of nationalists, well, nationalists, quote unquote, in the past, have done this where they would cuck their principles and abandon their principles and all of that. So it could be a lot more of a mainstream friendly, if you want to say the term or whatever. People, prime example is I've even talked about this on my show, Mood of the Nation, Marine Le Pen, who famously, people will have their opinions on Marine Le Pen, but she threw her dad under the bus. She did cuck a few certain opinions and all of that. And look what happened to her like fairly recently. She still got stabbed in the back by the same people who she thought was trying to, appease to so that she can get elected. So for this group of party, essentially are doing the similar or the exact same thing, which is abandoning the principles and seem to think that they can get ahead on within the political ladder. And I just want to tell those people, if you think you're journey to that is going to be much different, then you're sorely mistaken. Like, there will come a point that what happened to people like Marine Le Pen and all that in the past will exactly happen to them. If they think that being sensible, quote unquote, and being all like mainstream friendly and all that is going to help them in the long run, it's not. It's all going to come crashing down eventually. And we know it, and most importantly, they know it.
Well, thank you. Well, look, let's get into the second hour of the show and do these super chats. If you haven't super chatted, please do. We'd like, if you can be generous and support tonight, that would be really, really good. We haven't had as many super chats as we usually do. Usually by this time of the night, we have a stack to read out. I realise that things have been a bit more difficult for people as we've moved over to Entropy. But if you can help us out, that would be appreciated. Victor Groot Boss gave $5. Thank you so much. He said subscribed for $5. Well, thank you so much. As I say, we don't actually have those kind of subscriptions, but thank you for the donation. It's very much appreciated. Open Borders for Israel gave $5. Now, this was meant to be for Joel. Joel isn't here tonight. And he says, hey, Joel, do you know the Spanish commentator Brandon Martinez? For some reason, he is talking smack about you on X and Telegram. And that would have been a good drama question. But sadly, Joel isn't here to answer the drama. I have forwarded that on to Joel, though, so he can deal with that. Mr. Skywalker gave $3. Thank you so much. He said, thoughts on the current fires in Israel? Do you think the Palestinians started them? What do you think the Israeli response will be? I wasn't actually aware of fires in Israel, and I'm just Googling them now. They are actually saying that it's a terrorist act, that they've been started, you know, by Palestinians. I'm looking at several articles here. Arson suspect arrested. 20 injured as Israel evacuates towns. Calls for global help to fight the wildfires. Wildfires rage outside Jerusalem, forcing evacuations. Obviously, some sites are saying it was an act of terrorism. I think that'll be something that I would imagine the Israeli state lean into over time. Israel deploys troops to control massive wildfires near Jerusalem, major highways closed. I don't really know enough about it and didn't know about it up until now. But I should imagine, just like with most things that happen there, there will be a political spin put on this so that yet again, the Israeli state can demonize the rightful indigenous people of those lands and demonize Palestinian people. What do you think, Chief?
Yeah, same here. I was actually quite surprised to hear that sort of news. But if I were to add on to that, I wouldn't actually be, this might sound a bit conspiratorial or anything like that, but I actually wouldn't be surprised if maybe if it was someone from the Israeli side might have started the fires and maybe to try and blame it on the Palestinian people. I'm not saying that is the case. I ultimately don't know. But I wouldn't be surprised if something like that were to occur, because, I mean, from what I've seen in the past, the Israeli government and people tend to lie on certain things when it comes to that. And maybe this is a way to try and gain sympathy for the Israeli people. But there's one more point to make about that. I think there's come a point now where a lot more people are, maybe not just here in Britain, but I think also in America as well, there seems to be this idea of like, well, hold on a minute. Why should we support the Israeli people when, A, they seem to be a lot more of the aggressive types with these other countries, especially Palestine, and B, you know, they, you know, seem to not exactly be in our favor on certain things. So it's like, well, why should we help them when it comes to that? So, yeah, I'm actually quite surprised at that as well, to be honest with that. So, yeah.
Well, I think this is definitely going to be something that the Israelis use for more sympathy. I mean, never let an opportunity like this go to waste. I'm sure that's what Benjamin Netanyahu would say. Point gave $25. Thank you so much for your continued generosity. And he said donation. Aunt Sally gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, thank you, Mark and Moody. Always love hearing what he's got to say. Well, thank you so much. Detruska gave $5. Thank you so much. And said, keep on fighting. Well, thank you very much. The Resident Baker gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, good evening, Mark. Great to see the Chief on the show. I was worried you're going to have Douglas Murray on. Yeah, Douglas Murray's another one who's sort of detestable, isn't he? I mean, he's one who is an absolute Zionist hack of the worst, of sort of the worst order. He's just unbelievably terrible. He was on Joe Rogan recently. But one thing that always disappoints me about people like Douglas Murray. The people or people sort of like Douglas. There's a really weird sound coming from your side, Chief.
Yeah. Whistling. I was just going to say that's probably my dog, Otis, who's like sleeping next to me. I was hoping that maybe the sound won't come through. But yeah, so he's been pretty quiet up until now. But yeah, he's just chilling on the couch. So.
So you mean I've been thinking all night, what's that ridiculous whistling sound? And it's your dog snoring.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of dog sitting tonight. So I was hoping, again, he would be a little bit quieter. But yeah, so he's not too bad.
Face of a man who isn't impressed.
he's all right. I think he's quieting down now. So,
so at least we know what it is. Anyway, I'm going to go back to my point about Douglas Murray, if I can. Yeah. So I saw Douglas Murray on Joe Rogan. And I will say this. Douglas Murray is very well spoken, but he hasn't got his ducks in a row. He's not very good at debating. And when he's wheeled out to debate people, he basically always gets what you would say in boxing terms as carried. So in boxing, if you have a promising young boxer, they often carry them and put them in the ring with sort of what people know as sort of journeymen, sort of older boxers who have fought sort of 70 fights, you know, 120, lost 50. And they're there basically to get knocked out by a promising young boxer who then can add another win and another KO to his record. And sometimes older boxers get carried as well. So you might see an older boxer who is long past his prime, but still holds, you know, at least one belt. And, you know, they don't want to see him get humiliated. No one wants to see the old boy go into the ring and get absolutely pasted and lose his teeth. So they put him in the ring with somebody who just isn't up to snuff, who just, unfortunately, you know, is past their prime or is a youngster who can't really fight. And you also see this with exhibitions. You get these Hollywood stars who decide that they want to be a boxer and they go into the ring and somebody's been basically paid to take a fall, or they pay somebody who's just a washed up bum so the actor can knock them out and say, yeah, I've got 100% record. I'm now an official, you know, professional fighter. And I think that's kind of what happens with Douglas Murray. I'm not saying he isn't articulate. I'm not saying he's not well presented. He is both of those things. But he always goes up against people who don't quite have their ducks in a row and aren't the best at arguing. And I think this is another problem with the mainstream. The mainstream is starting to accept our talking points. But the people who are espousing our talking points, I find are always very, very weak at arguing them against slippery people like Douglas Murray. Now, if I was arguing about the issues in occupied Palestine with Douglas Murray, or somebody like Lady Michelle Renouf was making that argument, we would be smashing it out the park and he would be, you know, folded up like a wet paper towel and flicked to one side. But he's always put in with somebody who's a bit of a journeyman, who is a bit green, or almost has been paid to take a couple of heavy blows and end up on the mat just enough times so that Douglas doesn't walk away with egg on his face. And Douglas Murray is the guy who wrote the book The Strange Death of Europe. And his narrative is sort of nauseating. It's like, this all happened by accident. How did it happen? Who brought it about? Who will ever know? Donate all your money to Israel. You know, it's just like, oh, my God. And the thing with Douglas Murray that I find so repugnant is he is a slimy, smug tosser who basically is far too intelligent to not understand that the points he's making are disingenuous. I believe he knows exactly what's happening. I believe he's being paid off. And I can't say for sure that he's a compromised individual. But what I will say is it wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility that a homosexual, definitely not Douglas Murray, but that a homosexual could be caught with incriminating evidence and manipulated into a position where they have to espouse certain points by the state of Israel. I just want to make it clear, I'm totally not saying that's happened to Douglas Murray, but I'm saying that a hypothetical homosexual man could be manipulated into a position like that by a cunning Epstein-like character, which absolutely is not Douglas Murray, and I would never say such a thing. So, yeah, don't sue me. anyway, I don't know if you've got any points to make on that, mate.
Well, I mean, just a quick one. I mean, I do remember hearing about that Joe Rogan episode where he just couldn't handle it. I think it got to the point where there was another Joe Rogan episode later on with Jordan Peterson, if I remember correctly. And I think the whole reason why Peterson went on that show was because it was to try and save face for what Douglas Murray, how he handled in that whole debate, because I think people are definitely starting to see through the BS that is that side of the right, whether it's, you know, Ben Shapiro or like Douglas Murray or Jordan Peterson. No, it kind of actually goes back to what I was saying about the public and their thoughts on Israel and the whole Palestine conflict. No one's really buying it anymore. And I think people are starting to see through, like, well, hold on. Again, why are we helping and being allies with this country that seemed to be very aggressive and wanting to do this to, again, to Palestine or other neighboring countries and so on and so forth. So, yeah, that's all I have with Douglas Murray. So,
The resident baker's given another $3 and said Douglas Murray's partner is a Cohen. So people in the chat are saying the same, that apparently Douglas Murray is a homosexual married to a Jew. And I've got to say this, but you can see this kind of infiltration. And obviously, I'm not going to accuse Douglas Murray's partner of being sort of a plant. But when you see leading American and British politicians married to Jewish partners, you do wonder how many of those partners are doing a job for Israel. And I certainly wouldn't put it past the Israeli state, who obviously Mossad, the Israeli security services that boast of waging war by deception. You know, I wouldn't put it past Mossad to have a hand in something like picking, you know, attractive Jewish women to seduce and marry powerful Western leaders. And when you look at both the Conservative Party and Labour is run by Keir Starmer, and Keir Starmer is married to a Jewish woman and their children are being brought up Jewish. And Robert Jenrick, who is one of the most powerful Conservatives and is tipped to be a future Conservative Party leader, he narrowly missed out at the recent leadership race with Kemi Badenoch, but Jenrick is the same. He's another one that is married to a Jewish woman and they have Jewish children. So the children are being brought up as Jews. And the issue you have there is basically both sides of the house have that influence. Powerful male figures who are theoretically or potentially being controlled from the home by Jewish partners, and both their children are being brought up as Jewish. And Jenrick was one who said that he wanted a Star of David above every entry point into the UK. So every border that you would cross, every entry point, whether it be at a port or at an airport, you would have to walk under a Star of David to declare Britain's open allegiance with Israel. And I think that's an incredibly worrying thing when you've got somebody who's potentially the leader of the Conservative Party who wants to place the Israeli flag above every entry point to the UK. It leaves you in no doubt who's actually calling the shots and running the show.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like there's a running pattern of behavior where it's like these British politicians are marrying, you know, Jewish women. It's like, oh. And again, going back to what we were saying before, if we ever to make these kind of talking points, then we'd be viewed as like crackpot nationalists. Like, well, I mean, of course this is all going on behind the scenes, but you can't bring that up. Like Jews are not really that bad. I mean, like they're not in control of everything, guys. It's like, come on now. I mean, just hearing that alone, I mean, yeah, it's just it's a continuous running pattern of behavior there. So
it certainly is. And as I said, with Murray, I'm actually quite shocked because I didn't know that. You learn something new every day, I suppose. But that is something that, you know, sort of jumps out and you think to yourself, you know, really is, is that where we are? You know, and no wonder he ended up on Joe Rogan, and no wonder he was given an easy run of things. Jagdeep Jaino gave $10. Thank you so much. He said, "Hey, both, have you ever heard of the Manchester Pusher or the Bristol Pusher and the Smiley Faced Killers? This is the phenomena of young men in mainly the UK, USA, inexplicably going missing when out alone and later ending up dead in water. But the evidence points to foul play and a network of murderers." Have you heard of this?
I have not. No, this is news to me.
Well, this is really interesting because I am someone who is definitely very interested in criminology. And I've over the years, I've watched maybe thousands and thousands of sort of YouTube videos in, you know, based around criminology. But I've never heard of this issue of the Manchester Pusher or the Bristol Pusher. In fact, I'm going to Google it now to make sure it's a real thing. Yeah, This is a real thing. I'll read from The Independent. This is back from May 2017. "Is a pusher serial killer targeting Bristol after four bodies recovered in 4 months. Fears are growing of a so-called pusher serial killer shoving men into waterways in Bristol after four bodies were recovered from water in the city in 4 months. A post-mortem was due to take place on Friday after police divers recovered a man's body from the city's floating harbour on Thursday afternoon. Formal identifications yet take place, but police said they were keeping informed of the family of Jason Gergel, 33, who went missing after leaving a city centre bar around 2:40 a.m. last Saturday. The development comes after three other bodies were recovered from water in the city. They have been identified." When things like this happen and you tend to find bodies, sort of, especially of men, you know, face down in water, etc., I do think you may have on your hands a potential homosexual serial killer. That's what I would say that would point towards. If it's young men who have left clubs or have left bars and they get found like that, it would be certainly something that would spring to mind. Generally speaking, the homosexual community has harbored serial killers. And when I say harbored, probably that's a little bit unfair. The homosexual community hasn't covered it up. But due to some of the more wild sexual acts that go on in the homosexual community, and due to the fact you often have sort of married men sort of escaping family life to go and lead a double life within those communities, things that go on tend to be of a nature where, you know, don't ask, don't tell. And there's also been cases where in the UK where young men have sort of dabbled in sort of homosexual relationships, being drugged, being sexually abused, have woken up, not known where they are, but they don't want to talk about it because what they're doing is something that's a little bit taboo. It wouldn't surprise me. I don't know if you've got any take on this.
I mean, well, just to add on to that, there have been some serial killers in the past who are like famously homosexual. I think Jeffrey Dahmer was one of them. I know he's based in America, but I believe he was a homosexual. Was John Wayne Gacy was a homosexual? Again, I know that's like an American example, but and you can maybe say he tends to target, you know, young boys, if it were. But yeah, there seems to be like a kind of strange, I don't know if you want to call it a coincidence or maybe that's maybe something maybe more to it than that. But yeah, that's all I've got to say on the matter. I'm quite surprised at that. That was all the way back in 2017. But yeah, I'm quite surprised. So
it's quite interesting because somebody's posted in the chat the name of a guy. In fact, Jagdeep Jaino has actually named the guy in the chat who I was going to bring up. And his name is Reynard Ray Tambos Maruli Tua Sinaga, commonly known as Ray Sinaga. He's an Indonesian serial rapist who came to Britain and was convicted of 159 sex offences, including 138 rapes of young men in Manchester between 2015 and 2017 when he was living as a student. He was found guilty of drugging and sexually assaulting 48 men during this period, 44 of whom he raped, some repeatedly, although police believe he was offending for years beforehand. Sinaga was prosecuted in four trials between 2018 and 2020, was given concurrent life sentences with a minimum of 30 years years raised to 40 by the Court of Appeal. The Crown Prosecution Service describes Sinaga as being the most prolific rapist in British legal history. Probably not. I would probably say maybe the grooming gangs. Well, as an individual, the only person I could think who was raped more is probably Jimmy Savile. But either way, this is a migrant man who's come to Britain. And it says that Sinaga was believed by police to have raped or assaulted at least 206 men since 2015, which includes the 2 years before his arrival in the UK. In Manchester, he waited for potential victims outside nightclubs, pubs and similar venues in the early hours. He then offered his victims a stay at his flat, subsequently drugging and raping them. After some of the assaults, Sinaga boasted about his actions on WhatsApp. The sort of case that I'm talking about, and to have assaulted so many people and got away with it for so long and just been boasting about it. Those are the sort of things that happen, you know, around sort of communities where there are sort of taboos. And it wouldn't surprise me if somebody like that wasn't operating in Bristol, which has quite a, you know, large gay scene, to happen in Manchester. The deaths wouldn't surprise me if they weren't linked to a homosexual serial killer or somebody who had been touching people and then silenced those who maybe drugging them, raping them. And some people may have woke up during the rapes and or, you know, not or informed the sort of attacker they were going to go to the police or said the wrong thing and ended up face down in the water. So, yeah, pretty sickening. Jagdeep Jaino gave another $7.50. Thank you so much. He said, hey, Mark and Moody, do you think the slob might be compromised or an intelligent asset? Is it possible that someone has dirt on him? And was he at all involved in the leaking of the BNP membership? And also, how likely it is that Homoland is a honeypot? Well, I'll say this. The BNP membership list was leaked by a guy called Matt Single. Now, Matt Single was married or was the partner of a woman called Sadie Graham. And they were in the same faction as the slob, although I don't believe the slob had anything to do with the leaking of the membership list. And it would be that was a large split that he was involved in, but there was dozens of people on both sides. And you can't really say that everybody on one side of the split were sort of responsible for the membership list leak, which was proved in court to be done by one single person. So, yeah, that wasn't him. Do I think the slob has been compromised? In some ways, yes. Whether he's been compromised because the police have something on him, I don't know. But I think it's likely that whether it's actually somebody forcing him to do this or paying him off, however you see as compromised, yeah, the slob has been compromised. That's how you end up with a guy who, you know, a year or so ago was one of the most hardline people I've ever spoken to, pushing homosexual Zionism and saying that, you know, forcing people like Steve Laws out of his organization. What do you think, Chief?
I mean, it's kind of hard to say because I know Kenny when it comes to, I've spoken to him and interacted with him and all that. Based off of, not to say like anything too much or anything with that at all, but based off of what I've seen and what I've heard, in my opinion, it does kind of come off as he is, in my opinion at least, maybe he has been compromised in a certain way, because I remember that interview he had with, what was the name of the gentleman? It was Mark Heath, I think the guy's name was. Basically, they had that chat, a sit-down interview, and when Kenny made a talking point about, and Mark, please correct me if I'm wrong, if I get this wrong, but from what I remember him saying, like, oh, if you're a non-white living in Britain or moved to Britain, if you marry a British man or woman who is, you know, white, then you're British. I think I might be paraphrasing what he said, but that's what I remember him saying with that interview. And I remember watching that thinking, like, that's not what you like believe in. That's complete BS. I mean, to the point where I'm just like, does he actually genuinely believe that? Or is he kind of like reading off a script for somebody? And I tend to believe the latter, because again, based off of what I know of him and what I've spoken to him about in the past and all of that, it does kind of come off as he has been compromised. And this is all, and the thing is too, I know I'm kind of like over going along, but I just, it's kind of like hard to talk about in a way, because I don't tend to call people or groups fed ups or anything like that at all, unless I have some any solid points to make or any concrete evidence to back up type of thing. But again, from what I've seen and what I've heard, it does seem to be some form of a compromise when it comes to that particular group. And one final point with this year's conference, you can even say with last year's conference, because I don't know what happened with this year's conference in terms of the people that went to the venue, but that venue got doxxed again. And this is the second time that this had happened. I mean, we know what happened last year. The Reds showed up. They were taking photographs. They were taking videos of the people participating as guests or attendants or whatever. Now, again, for the people that do go to the homeland conferences and all that who wish to be anonymous, well, I mean, don't act all surprised. Again, I hope this doesn't happen, but don't act surprised when you do get doxxed. And I think there is some form of a compromise there with regards to that. And again, that's only just my opinion when it comes to that.
Thank you. Thin Red Line gave $25. Thank you so much. So I think some part of the elite is going to want serious restriction on immigration and even remigration in order to counter the rise of China and Russia. And they think that if we continue on the current trajectory, they will lose to China and Russia. That's an interesting thought process. I mean, I think the elite would still want white men to use as soldiers because white men are good at doing that. White men are good at fighting. They're good at going out there and conquering. They are known for their ability when it comes to conquest. But I'm not sure whether the global elite is quite ready to start restricting immigration to bring that about. And if they do use white men to fight, that will just lead to a further depletion of our numbers. I can imagine them sending, you know, millions of young men abroad from, you know, from all over the Western world, you know, to go to the Middle East to fight in a war in Iran. It'd be horrific. I can imagine that happening. And I can imagine white men going and fighting that war. And I can imagine people like Donald Trump, Douglas Murray, even maybe Tommy Robinson, winding up young guys to go and fight, which is something I always find very worrying, because that's the last thing we want, is a major war with a country like Iran, and we end up being sucked into another situation where we destabilize the Middle East. And, you know, we end up with hundreds of thousands of Iranian migrants pouring into the UK. And then eventually, when we give the country back to its rightful owners, all the people who assisted us end up being given immediate passports, like we've seen with Afghanistan. There's been a massive influx of Afghans into Britain who all aided Western occupiers. And now we have to take them because they're going to be killed because they betrayed their own kinsmen. Simple as that. Now, do I think that the West are going to say, look, we need to stop immigration to prevent sort of China and Russia? I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because when you look at the European Union, when you look at the powers that are actually or the parties that are actually in power in Europe at the moment, they are all still very much building themselves or building the economy around immigration. And as I've explained before, that is a major problem. If they started reducing the UK population, the economy would go just into complete recession. One of the reasons the economy keeps growing in the UK is because of immigration, because it brings in consumers and it boosts the housing market. And I think we've got in this cycle of endless rises in GDP. And because we're in that cycle of endless rises in GDP, I think the problem that we're seeing now is no government knows how to say, look, things are bad, but the only way to get out of this is to change the economy. And that means there has to be deflationary pressures. That's going to bring prices down. It is going to lower GDP. It's going to bring house prices down, but it's going to make the cost of living better for everyone. And the best way to bring about deflationary pressure is to reduce immigration, and actually to have net negative migration, where we're sending hundreds of thousands of millions of people back. And that will not only cause deflationary pressures, it will not only reduce GDP, but it will also allow the NHS to breathe. It will also allow GPs waiting lists to fall. It will allow class sizes to fall, and it will ease all of the overcrowding in Britain. But I can't see any government doing that, because the media and the government are still largely basing a country's success around the idea of ever-growing GDP. And you can't keep growing the GDP of non-manufacturing countries without growing the number of consumers. Now, if Britain was still a manufacturing nation, you could, with mechanization and with a highly trained, smaller indigenous workforce, increase our manufacturing, increase our exports, and still grow GDP. But we're not a manufacturing nation. We are a nation of consumers. And so many industries now rely on migrants, migrant workers, and the money that mass migration brings into the country, not least the housing market, that I think it's going to be very hard for any government to divorce themselves from mass migration, not least because we have that aging white population. And the problem there is those people are going to need the carers. And this problem has been a problem that's been built over decades. Post-Second World War, we have been shifted into this position by materialism, hedonism, feminism, a complete reordering of the way that family life is organized. This has taken decades. And when something takes decades and then accelerates and accelerates and accelerates, even if you start to turn it round, unless you have somebody like me and a dedicated group of radicals take power, which is extremely unlikely to happen, and those dedicated radicals are willing to rip up the rule book. And look, I'm no fan of people like Mao. I'm no fan of people like Lenin. But to give them credit, they were dedicated radicals that weren't scared of ripping up the rule book. Every time you see a right-wing government come to power, whether it's Meloni in Italy, whether it's Trump in America, or even if it was Farage in the UK, they all talk the talk until they're shown the figures on the economy. And at that point, they all back off everything they've said. And Trump says, no, we're going to need record migration because there's going to be so many factories. We're going to need the migrants to pump out all these American products. Oh, well, no, we can't deport all the illegals because they work on the farms. They work in the hotels. These are literally the things he's saying, because he's realized that if he deports all the illegals, the farms in places like California, the hotels all over the South, and the hospitality industry that more or less runs across the entire South of America is going to completely collapse. And when they bring back manufacturing, they're going to fill those manufacturing jobs with migrants because there aren't young whites to do that work. And you've already seen this in America with that snake Elon Musk. Elon Musk has been saying, look, you know, we're going to make things better. But then he's like, oh, but we're going to lay off all the American workers and just bring in cheap labor.
Yeah, we're gonna bring in H-1B1 Indian workers or something like that. It's just like I do feel bad for the Americans at this point, because yeah, they got Trump coming into office for the second time, and people saw through what happened during the Biden administration, and yeah, it was a complete cluster mess of that administration, to say the least. And Trump, you know, to a lot of people, they saw what happened between 2016 and 2020, and they were just like, well, it could have been a bit better, but hopefully this time around Trump will, you know, maybe sort some things out. And then, yeah, I was definitely going to say earlier on that, you know, Trump is now allowing these illegal immigrants to remain in America so that they can work in some areas. And it's just like, it's almost like at this point, you just really can't win, can you? Like, I mean, people do try, but they just can't win. I do feel bad for the Americans at this point, so.
Well, I think the problem is, in America, at the time of the last census, which was 2020, white Americans officially made up 61.6% of the population. Now, when you account for illegal immigrants, white Americans, you know, 5 years ago, definitely made up less than 60%. I would say white Americans make up between 54 and 55% of the population in America now. Maybe less, I don't know, depending on whose illegal immigration statistics you take on board. You know, if it's the official ones, there's 12 million. If it's, you know, nationalist commentators have guessed around 18 million, and people like Ann Coulter have sort of guessed maybe up to 40 million. You know, so there's wide ranging guesstimates there. But one thing that's really worrying is, in 2020, white Americans, and by when I say white Americans, I don't mean the 73%, which includes sort of Hispanics and people from the Middle East that they class as white. I mean actual Europeans. European Americans made up less than 50% of the population in the age bracket 35 and under. Now, ages 18 to 35 are the key breeding ground. And if the white Americans were already a minority in the key breeding age groups in 2020, with the 4 years of Biden's complete open borders and the fact that the migrants and non-white Americans breed at a more rapid rate, I don't think you could turn that around in America unless you literally had an incredible separation where somebody came in who was truly radical and said, look, we're having white states and we're having non-white states. And, you know, some states are basically like California, screw it. You're all going to be going forced to move in California, but there's going to be a whites only zone. And you literally had a new United States, which maybe had 10, 15 states, which all had to be constitutionally 90% plus white European. But are you going to get that? Probably not. And people in the chat now are saying that whites are already a minority in places like California and Texas. Well, you know, the great state of Texas, you know, once this sort of Wild West state where men were men and they were cattle ranchers and they were oil barons. You know, remember Dallas, the show, you know, it's what? It's a Mexican state. It was made up, gave $15. Thank you so much. He said, keep up the great work, both of you. Just like he did with Brexit, if Farage ever did become PM, he would instantly cuck on what he was elected for. I dislike him, but he's still slightly preferable to the Uni party. I don't think Farage did cuck on Brexit. I don't want to sort of counter-signal you, and thank you for the donations, but I don't think Farage did cuck on Brexit. It was David Cameron that cucked on Brexit. David Cameron said that if he was... Was it Article 21 that he had to trigger to trigger Brexit? David Cameron basically said there was going to be an in-out referendum and he would respect the views of the public and he would trigger the clause immediately that signaled the exit of Britain from the EU. And the morning after the vote, he stood outside Downing Street and resigned and did not trigger the clause for Britain to leave. I'm just going to Google it. What was the clause for Britain to leave EU? Article 50, that was it. I think I got it wrong. I said Article 21. Article 50 allows a member state to withdraw. It was originally drafted by a British crossbench peer and former diplomat, Lord Kerr of Kinlochard. Where the hell's that? The Secretary General of the European Convention, which drafted the Constitutional Treaty for the European Union. So he could trigger Article 50. He didn't. And when Article 50 wasn't triggered the day after, there was a protracted leadership challenge. And then when Theresa May took power and took control of the Conservative Party, there was no impetus for her to trigger Article 50 because she wasn't the one who promised to trigger it. And it dragged it out for years and we never got the Brexit we wanted. If there's one thing I'll say for Nigel Farage, he really hated the European Union. And I think if he was in a position to trigger Article 50 immediately, I think that's the one thing he wouldn't have reneged on. I would say the thing that he reneged on the most was immigration. He's always been someone who's talked the talk over immigration, but then backed off. Dusty gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, thanks, Mark. And Saturn, five gave $3. Thank you so much. Said, hi, chaps. Or Woolly or the Bruins. Don't know what that means. That's something for you.
Oh, yeah. Like that, it's a Oor Willy or the Bruins. They're basically classic Scottish. I don't want to say magazines, but I think like comic books. They were like, they're kind of like slice of life type of comics you would get in Scotland. So you have stuff like the Beano and the Dandy, but the purely Scottish stuff you would get are like Oor Willy or the Bruins, which are pretty popular. I think they've been around like for, I'm not too sure when exactly, but they've been going on for a long, long time. I mean, I know that my grandparents, my nan especially, is quite a fan of those books. She does have quite a collection, and yeah, it does. It's quite popular up here in Scotland. So
I didn't know that. When I was a kid, the Dandy, because the Dandy and the Beano were absolutely huge in the UK. These sort of like children's comics. But I'll say this: when I was a kid, people did read them, but over time, it's been amazing to see their decline. And one thing I have noticed is there's been so many sort of incredible bits of sort of British, you know, literature, whether it's comics or books, etc., that have been completely sort of forgotten to time with the digital revolution. And obviously, I'm not some Luddite who's against technology or anything like that. But I will say, I do think it's sad that these publications, which were once much loved all over Britain, have, you know, almost completely been forgotten. And if you said to kids today, you know, what's the Dandy or the Beano? I don't think anyone would ever know what you were talking about. I mean, to talk about those two comics, I'll read from the Wikipedia. The Dandy was a Scottish children's comic published by the Dundee-based publisher DC Thompson. The first issue was printed in 1937. One of the best-selling comics in the UK, along with the Beano, the Dandy reached sales of 2 million per week in the 1950s. The final printed edition was issued on the 4th of December 2012, the comic's 75th anniversary, after sales slumped to just 8,000 a week. And the Beano, which was sort of the sort of sister comic, I think that's still going.
I think the Beano's still going. Yeah, I remember actually seeing, I can't remember what shop or supermarket it was, but I was just in there just to get a couple of things. And I remember on the newspaper stand there was the Beano, and I was like, is that actually still being published? Because I thought that was cancelled. Same thing with the Dandy. And sure enough, I think the Beano is still going, but I think it's also cupped to the whole political correctness stuff. Because on the cover, there was Dennis the Menace and Nasher, but there was also a black chick, I think. I remember seeing, I'm just like, oh, God. They've been compromised as well, haven't they?
And another one that was really massive was 2000 AD, which obviously sort of spawned Judge Dredd. And 2000 AD was a bit more sort of adult, but then there was sort of like Dandy and the Beano. And these had massive circulations and were a huge part of, you know, sort of children's upbringing, you know, in the sort of, you know, 70s, like in the 80s, when we used to go to like the sweet shop, there was always the Dandy, the Beano, all the rest. And people used to love them. And the Wolves, they always have like free gifts on the covers. And then there was, I'd say, 2000 AD. Sad to see all these things go and to be replaced by sort of, I'd probably say, more sort of mainstream slop. These Blue Eyes gave $5. Thank you so much. Said global help for some fire in Israel. Is there anything that those people are willing to do for themselves? How much have we already given them? And they're asking for more for this. Well, I mean, I don't know if I can get into trouble for saying this, but Israel is sort of a true parasite nation. It absolutely cannot stand on its own two feet, has never attempted to stand on its own two feet, and constantly lives off the kindness of others and charity. And as such, I don't think if Western support for Israel was withdrawn, the place would just it would just cripple itself. It can't survive without Western money. And every time something happens there, the West give more. But it's not just taxpayers' money. There are these absolutely cooked sort of Zio-Christian groups that are, they call themselves, what are they? Yeah, do they call them? Christian Zionists, that's what they call themselves. These Christian Zionist groups.
I was, sorry, Mark. I was going to say, is it not a Christian nationalist or something like that? No. Or is that something?
No, they call them Christians. They call themselves Christian Zionists. Christian nationalists are the ones that believe that the chosen people of the Old Testament were actually white Europeans and not Jews.
Ah, right. Gotcha. I thought it was that maybe the same thing, but no, it's clearly not the case. So that's fine.
Yeah, and so these Christian Zionists, they raise millions a year. And then, as I say, another one, I can't remember his name, that old guy who's on YouTube that everyone listens to, who's always going to Israel to build kibbutzes for them. I forget his name now, he's really irritating. YouTube guy, old man, always talks about how much he loves Israel, then speaks badly of people who don't. But all the boomers love him on YouTube. Somebody will, I've spoken about him before. History debunked. That's it. The old guy.
Right.
Yeah, he's back in Israel now. He's probably running around throwing buckets of water on the fires and crying his eyes out. What a pain in the ass. You know, these people are, I mean, I wanted to go on stream with him and debate him. There's no debating that guy. He'd run a mile before he debated somebody like me because he's so far, you know, up the collective Israeli anus. All you can see is his toenails. Unbelievable. And he always claims that he's not a Jew. He's 1,000,000%. When I saw his YouTube sort of blowing up, I knew why that was blowing up. That was a kosher operation. Absolutely. Well, look, guys, that brings us to the end of the Super Chats. Super Chats have been a bit slower than usual tonight. It's the first slow night I've had all year. But if anyone wants a Super Chat last minute or Super Chat or contribute while I'm not online, they absolutely can. Or if there's anyone who wants to ask any questions that are non-paid questions quickly, they can do, because we've still got another 10 minutes. And if you want to support the show and if you want to support me, people have been very generous earlier in the month. And I don't expect every night to be a banger where I'm making sort of, you know, 400 plus or anything like that. But it has been a bit slow. And if anyone wants to ask anything tonight, they're more than welcome to, you know. So I think we've got one question. Comes from Carl Otter. He says, how are Laura and Sam doing? They're doing really well. Laura and Sam are spending a lot more time together, but unfortunately, the restrictions placed on Sam are so incredibly restrictive. He has to sort of act as though he's a flight risk. So he isn't allowed to live with Laura and their two daughters. He has to live at a hostel and he has to sign into that. There's a curfew, which I think is at 10 at night, but he has to sign in at the hostel. I believe it's at 1 p.m. every day because they class him as a flight risk. And he has one of those ankle tags on constantly, a GPS monitor, so they can check where he is. You know, it's scandalous. Albion Forever says, will you review the Louis Theroux documentary on Israel? Yes, I will. I don't know what to do this Sunday. I've got a live stream on Friday. Don't know what to do on Sunday. As I said, Nationalist 18 is cancelled because Natty's had a baby. He didn't personally obviously have a baby, but congratulations, Natty, because your wife did. I'm definitely going to review that. What would people like when I review it? Would people like me to watch it live and respond to it? I could do that next Sunday, or do people have any other plans? Would people like me to do it in a different way? What do you guys think? Watch it live or do a review? I think watching it live would be sort of a better way, a better way to do it. But it's up to you guys. What do you think? Let me know in the chat. And as I say, if there's any other questions, do fire them over now. Have you seen the Louis Theroux documentary?
No, I've not seen that. The only Louis Theroux documentaries I've ever seen are the ones about the porn industry. I think it was like one in the 90s and then a follow-up one, but it was like years later. There was another one I've watched about the Westboro Baptist Church, and there was another one I remember watching. I think it was the autism one, where it's like you get to see the actual full-on autism kind of thing from people. But yeah, in terms of that one about Israel, I've not seen that one, to be honest. So
okay, now the next thing I was going to ask, we've actually got another question here from Jagdeep Jain, who gave another $5. Thank you so much. So final question: do you think that Western fiat currencies could become hyperinflated? That's an interesting question. He goes on to say, some people think this will happen before central bank digital currencies are ushered in by Zog. Do you think gold, silver, crypto are good investments to protect wealth? I think gold, silver and crypto are good investments. I especially think people should, you know, consider cryptocurrencies, and there's lots of good options there. What I will say, though, is do I think there will be hyperinflation? I'll say this: never before have the governments of the West had so much control over currency and over money. And never before have banks worked so closely with government to control the money supply. As such, they can literally create money at the touch of a button. And I'm sure they could reissue currency or have a reset as they see fit. And because of that, I think there's always been a tendency for people within nationalist circles to make predictions that we're close to a collapse. I actually think the West is more stable than a lot of dissidents do. I think Keith Woods agrees with this. I think the West is actually more stable than a lot of dissidents believe. And I think if there was a currency collapse, I think people think it would play into our hands. However, I'm not too sure about that. Because it could be something that would usher in a secure new form of currency that was basically a system of uber monitoring. And at that point, you're in a world where there is sort of a digital currency, where everything's tied up in some kind of government-controlled blockchain, where everything you do is seen by the government, and any form of dissent or activity that the government doesn't like is immediately met with a block on your digital wallet. Now, I think there's a couple of things I'll say. I think owning things is important. And I'm not a materialist, but if you own things like gold and silver, they have value. But also if you own certain collectibles or have things that have an intrinsic value, that's good as well. Something I'm always really worried about, especially as an avid gamer, is the loss of physical media. You know, things like this won't mean a lot to a lot of people, but it means a lot to me, is you buy a games console, like let's say the Wii years ago, and you buy games on the digital store, then Nintendo announced that those games or the digital store is closing, and if you haven't got copies of those games on your system, you can never access them again, and they're lost to time. And I think owning physical things that have value and have use is also important. And I say that because if there is ever a true collapse, gold might not be as important as things like a functioning motor vehicle, or, you know, good tools that are in good working order, or the ability to grow crops, or to build shelter and repair your own house. I think all of these things are very important. So I don't think there's going to be a collapse. But if there was a total collapse, I'm not sure if anything outside of food, water, and the ability to food, water, medical aid, and the ability to defend yourself would actually be important. And if there is an economic collapse, which I don't think is actually coming, I think there will be increasing inflation. But if there was an economic collapse, it might not work out to our favour. It might be something where the powers that be go for a full swoop and take even more power.
Yeah, 100% agree. I'll just be short and sweet. And yeah, just if you can buy physical media, if you can when it comes to that, because yeah, there's going to come a point where if we're living in the complete digital age, then if you, they'll say, like, oh, you own it, but you don't really own it. So I would definitely agree with the idea of buy physical media. I mean, I tend to buy physical copies of video games when it comes to that, because you actually do have the physical copy and then you own it. So, and yeah, as Mark pointed out, if you have a digital version, there's going to come a point where that will be lost and you're never going to be able to have it again. So yeah, in short, yeah, buy physical media if possible.
It's interesting. And one thing I've noticed as well in the last sort of few years is physical media, whether it be, disc-based media for viewing, so sort of Blu-rays or sort of cartridge or disc-based media for games, has become extremely expensive. But the digital equivalent, a download, has become really, really cheap. So you might want a game like, say, like a game like Ninja Gaiden Trilogy, that the remasters, that on physical media, you're talking about £50-60 for all three games. But you can buy it on the eShop for $16.99. And I mean, at that point, they've kind of got your arm up your back. If you want to play it, you can invest and get the physical cartridge. So you've got the physical cartridge, but it is going to cost you nearly three times the price. And I believe that we are now being priced out of physical media, and tying that in with the idea of digital currencies, a blockchain, government monitoring, we truly are moving to an era where you will own nothing and you will be happy with it. You know, and I think it's very, very worrying. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the show. It's been a really entertaining show with Chief Moody. Firstly, I'd like to say thanks, Chief. Give us your final thoughts and then we'll shut things down.
Yeah, so it's been, again, I do apologize for leaving the show briefly because of the internet connection. But other than that, it's been a really good show. It's actually been pretty quick, surprisingly, and enjoyed the topics we discussed and hope to be back on the show at some point. So, yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great having you on. I'd just like to say a massive, massive thank you, Chief Moody. A massive thank you to all those who donated so generously. If you want to donate after the show, please do via the Entropy links or via cryptocurrency. You can donate 24/7 via those links, and every penny is truly appreciated. And I'd like to thank everyone who donated so generously tonight. Thank you very much. I'd also like to thank everyone who tuned in. Now, I will be back later in the week. I will be back on Friday for our election roundup. We made a few predictions tonight. We discussed the elections tonight, but there'll be a proper breakdown with me live on Friday night. Please tune in for that. And I'll be back for something on Sunday. And later in the month, I will be reviewing Louis Theroux's The Settlers. So look forward to that. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you so much to Chief Moody. Thank you to everyone who donated. And thank you to everyone who tuned in. I love you all, and I'll see you again same time next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you, everybody, and good night.